They did continue, though, to operate the with our Southern Pine using the Western equipment, but we did eventually shut down that operation and go genuinely to Southern Pine. That much of the world, you can see the carryover at our Pineland mill now.
We'll stop the tape right here for a quick break. Mr. Knudsen's telling me about their barn storming days of piloting. Go ahead and continue and tell about the professional pilots and the non-professional pilots.
Yeah, that was just kind of a pickup over. We were talking about the Pine Bough Cafe down here on the street, and I used to always look for that at night when coming home flying. Mr. McQueen and Horace Stubblefield and I used to do the bulk of the flying for the company, and almost any time that Arthur or Carol Allen or Latney, when they needed to go somewhere, we wanted to find out how to get them there. And so we were pilots of call and one of the many hats that we wore. And coming in late at night, the Pine Bough sign was a very prominent. It was lighted, and you could see it a long way, so we could fly till we could catch the highway and come down the highway, and then we'd see that sign and start a procedure turn that would turn us right over the current office building, the corporate office building, and then over the Lottie Temple Civic Center,
yeah.
Where the...
Of course, that wasn't there then.
The big orchard of pecans that are still there,
yeah,
were there at that time. We'd come in right over the top of those pecan trees, and the runway was right behind the old tin barn or...
The Lumberlast kind of building.
The Lumberlast right building is sitting it right in the middle of the runway. And as we came in, we'd drop landing gear and turn on the lights and run the cows off the runway. Those belonged to one of our old logging contractors who had a grazing right down here, and the darn cows would get out there in the middle of the runway, so we'd always have to run them off the runway and then come back around and land, and then go clean the airplanes up.
Now, were you flying when you came to work in 59?
Well, I started flying with Mr. McQueen down here at that
down
time.
Down here you started, and so this would be early 60s?
This is the late 50s.
Late 50s, okay.
And, Stubby had been flying continuously from the time he got out of service, and
he was in World War II.
Yeah, and of course John Booker was involved in many engineering tasks and didn't have quite the time to spend doing the flying. But I don't recall that he did much flying, and neither did Joe Denman. And Joe was a Second World War aviator as well, but Joe didn't start. Again, you had your primary duties, and Joe was more valuable to us as engineer, operations, promoter sort of guy, and John Booker the same way. Then, and I guess they could spare me and Stubby to do a little flying. And we were more indispensable. Let's put it that way. We used the airplane though later on to. As spray planes to control undesirable weed species on much of our timberland, so that the pine that we were primarily interested in would get a good jump and grow. So we had spray planes, we had all kinds of activities going on, and that was just one of the many things. Everybody had wore several hats, and also at those Saturday morning meetings, we discussed all of the activities, and people were well knowledgeable of what the other guy was doing, and wherever you could be of assistance to him in promoting and expanding the projects, that's what you were supposed to do. And you didn't get paid for going out and surveying on Saturdays either. That was just one of your jobs.
You just have to do it.
Yeah. Kenneth Nelson and Dennis Maynard did the bulk of that though. And
and tell me a little bit more about Dennis Maynard. What exactly he
Dennis Maynard was
surveying?
A forester from Stephen F. Austin, and came to us shortly after Bill Nichols came. I mentioned Bill Nichols was the first degreed forester at the company, but Dennis Maynard was out of the military during the Second World War as well, and went back and finished up. And so he wasn't far behind Bill Nichols. He was just a couple of years behind Bill. And Dennis was an astonishing, bright forester that really contributed to our operations and was really a godsend to Kenneth and to Mr. Kinley. He was a great surveyor, and if you'll look at the land records and our tax records and so on, his marks on them everywhere.
What about Bob Farley? I've come
Bobby
across
Farley.
That name.
Bobby Farley was another employee of the forest operation or forest division. He worked with Kenneth Nelson. It was about the same time as
was he a degree
Bill.
Forester?
I don't recall that he was. No, he was not. But he was a very qualified land manager and worked with Kenneth up until the time that we started the new fiberboard plant, and that was in the mid to late 50s as well, late 50s. And Bobby Farley went to work with Carol Allen at the fiberboard plant. So just another indication of how our people kind of flexed and moved into projects that they would contribute to.
We were talking earlier about the plywood plant. Go in a little chronological order, that some of the different and maybe new industries are new to Dibble, other than just Dimension Lumber. Like I said, we just talked about the plywood plant. Maybe going up through the fiberboard plant, particle board, and then get into paper and how those changes in manufacturing and the market and so forth, how that related to your job in the logging aspect.
Well, all of these enterprises were virtually directly come from our forest and our natural resources. And so as we would move along with our sawmill, for example, we had squares from sawing lumber. These squares was the raw material that went to the handle factory, and Mr. White and his son Herb would convert them into handles, and they became the largest handle factory in the world. The same thing was true with the sawdust. We were having to burn it or haul it off. At the same time, Arthur had vision there of using that as a raw material for some product, and that's when the fiberboard plant came along. One of the most profitable enterprises that we ever had. Even to this day, that fiberboard plant is a very keen developer of earnings, and off and on it's been miraculous, just the amounts that it generates. So it was super well. And then along with that, Mr. Jim Love, who was very instrumental here in civic enterprises, whether it be music or the library, whatever. He opened up the Lovewood Products plant. They used bark that we were throwing away again or burning as fuel, and he used that as a miracle mulch for
mulch.
That became very profitable. And another one, he manufactured wood flour. And that's
and
from.
Tell us what that was from and what it would be used.
The wood flour was a very finely powdered sort of wood fiber, and it was used by applying a resin to it and then into a mold and heated, and it made such products as you can imagine molding toilet seats. And we had some factories in Pineland that John Booker and Mr. Sweeney operated over there for years at very profitably.
So they used wood flour from
they used
from
the wood flour, and that was an example. Then going on from that came from the fiberboard to some high-density type of board, and then from that to a different product called particle board. Bill Oates was one of our early people working with John Booker over at Pineland, where we bought, again, here we are buying a factory from Europe because we just weren't generating that kind of equipment yet. So we had to operate with the equipment available, and then so they brought in a factory from Germany and operated it very profitably. But as the new as the technology improved, higher grade materials and better products were being made by the improved factory. So we leaped from that factory into a new one, and then eventually, just like with the one we're operating today, that John McLean is operating up here at here in Diboll. So all of these are manufacturing opportunities of raw materials and technology, and a mindset. And that mindset was always Arthur Temple.
Now, I realize that a lot of that is as you described, wood waste or waste from other processes. Did that impact in any way the forestry end of what types of trees to grow? I guess my question is there special considerations
in
forestry
no.
and in logging?
By and large, our improved forests are able to supply the materials and the requirements for all of these processes, but there are some opportunities to do some special things with the improved forest technology. Example being now, while pine trees per se, planted and growing in the natural, have limbs on them almost down close to the ground, and as they grow older they kind of self-prune a little bit. But these limbs create knots and other kinds of abrogations that aren't desirable to a lot of our products. So today, we have certain high-grade stands where they're going out and trimming these with long-limbed saws, and they limb them. They cut the limbs off, and the logs, the trees will clean up earlier and make more clear lumber. So this is a case of growing clear saw logs so that you can have very keen, high-grade lumber that's very desirable to look at for clear purposes. And so we are doing some things like that, a number of projects, a lot of them in hardwood. And hardwoods was such a cheap product. It just didn't have much interest except in ties and board row, which we think everybody understands board row. Used to lay down kind of a corduroy road so that vehicles can get to an oil site
or like
that.
Pallets.
And outside of that, though, hardwoods in Texas, by and large, were of lower grade than they are in the Mississippi.
What time period are you referring to? You said that hardwoods were of lower grade.
The hardwood species, whether it be in the oaks, the cypress, all of them were of lower grades. The higher grades were taken out early in the century by Arthur's predecessors.
Right, because they had at one time three sawmills. Mm-hmm. One of them was specifically hardwood. The mill two was hard or pine.
And they very selectively cut only the best trees. Yeah. So what was left were low grade trees. And the low-grade trees just didn't find much interest except, as I say, into some of these other products. They just didn't have much dollar value.
Were these being deadened when you came in
there,
the 50s?
There were some processes where they were girdling trees in order to just take them out of competition and let the pine that's growing intermingling with them.
And was that true of the industry as a whole?
Well, that's pretty true of the whole industry, but not all of them, you know, could afford that luxury. Because it's a long-term deal to go out there and girdle trees that are 36, 40, 50 inches, you know, and these were, but were undesirable species. Post oaks, for example. Nobody wanted post oaks, but they were these big, huge trees, and when you girdle them and kill them, and then you're letting the little pines that are on the ground grow up, you can imagine how many years it takes to get your investment back. So that wasn't a very attractive enterprise for a lot of people. it was experimental to a large degree. Then we started using herbicides and flying it by plane, and that's one of the issues, one of the areas that I worked with Mr. McQueen on. We had a couple of airplanes that were equipped to do spraying, and we would fly with various chemicals, and some of it later we find are chemicals that we probably would not use for that purpose again, but at that time, until we were knowledgeable. But once we did use spraying techniques, though, to combat the undesirable species and let our better species get a jump and use the soil attributes most effectively. So that so the hardwoods we just didn't. And now today, though, we have a very strong team in our forest operations under Jack Sweeney Jr. That's his, and they're making some real strong efforts in developing hardwoods.
Just recently hired a forest manager, didn't you?
And not only that, but we're people, but developing the technology, doing a lot of development of technology and experimentation that others haven't chosen to do. But and we feel that in the future that will be a very strong plus for us.
And as I understand it, there's really no hardwood manufacturing site in our immediate area, so most of the hardwood logs, aren't they being sold to others elsewhere?
Yeah, we do not currently operate any hardwood operations for lumber or solid wood products. In center, a couple of mills up a little further into northern Northeast Texas or into Louisiana, Arkansas. There are a few mills around that will travel a great many miles to get good quality hardwood, but again, they're very selective, and the value really still hasn't excited a lot of people yet.
Comment a little bit more on the logging end of it with these new, and I guess I'm specifically thinking of paper. You know, beginning, I guess, in the early to mid-70s with the paper mill at Evadale. What operations did you inherit or continue? Any operations that East Tex was doing, or did...
Well, we affected...
What was the relationship there?
We affected the technology used there quickly and early after converting to the longer logs. The ability to, with the skidders and the hydraulic heel boom loaders and the big trucks. Strange that comes up, but I recall on a Sunday, after a long series of heavy rains, Southland Paper Mill was in dire straits for fiber. They were literally running out of wood. All of their operations was 4-foot wood. Now, what I mean by that is they had crews out there that just virtually would cut with a power saw pine timber into 4-foot sticks, and they'd load it by hand on trucks and then drive the trucks to the mill.
Stacked like firewood. Crossways with the road, not lengthwise.
Yeah, and across the road they'd be, it's an 8-foot bed, that was the legal width that they were permitted to operate. But with the wet weather, these small trucks and doing it by hand, they could not get in the woods to get sufficient quantities of wood to operate that mill. And Harvey Sprott, Hayes Smith was the, Harvey Sprott was the manager of forest operations. Hayes Smith was in charge of raw materials, and he called me on a Sunday and was asking what could I do to help him. The mill was going to shut down without wood.
You're talking about Southland, these Sprott and Hayes Mills of Southland.
Now, at that time, I'm not sure that I think we were probably out of the partnership with them, but at one time we owned a portion of Southland Paper Mill. And Temple Weber served, our chairman of the board served on that board. But eventually we liquidated our interaction with them. And at the time I was referring to, though, with the where they were having a trouble for wood supply, I don't remember whether we had sold our portion of Southland Paper Mill or not. But at any rate,
just before the Time East Hex merger,
mm-hmm.
Time
yes. Creek, oh, yes.
Yeah,
so oh, yes.
Before the Temples had their own paper mill.
Yeah. Okay. And so we're on that request from Hayes, and of course we were all working together in East Texas. It wasn't just they weren't always competitors. We had friends, even if they were competitors, and
yeah.
we didn't want to see anybody suffer like that. So I said, well, sure, I've got a couple of spare contractors that I could send over to them, and they had the new technology, the skidders and the big trucks and the hydraulic loaders, and if anybody could pull them out of a strut, they could. So I remember sending Dee Hanna and I've forgotten the other contractors, but two or three of them over in short order because of the vast improvement in the ability for these skidders to operate in wet weather and to get the trucks out and on the highway and to haul large, long, and of course this was all long wood. And so they had to learn how to buck it up. Well, they found out that hauling long wood to the paper mill, and they had bucking saws put in, and they started cutting it up. And
bucking, you mean you're taking the limbs off?
No, cutting it. Cuts them into shorter pieces
because
they come in,
okay.
in pieces that may be 60 feet long.
Right.
So they cut them into these 4-foot pieces that Southland Paper Mill customarily, was set up to use. They have it's a ground wood process, and you have to, and that uses 4-foot sticks of wood. So they'd have to buck these long pieces at their mill
at
into
the
short
mill,
pieces
right.
in order to feed them into the mill. But the longer logs are cutting them in long form is what facilitated and used the advantage of the skidders and the hydraulic loaders and the big trucks. If we were to try to operate on short wood out in the woods, it was a real problem. And you were asking earlier about the applications and how changing technology at the mills, how that affected forestry or logging harvesting operations. Yeah, it does. And it didn't take long after that illustration I just made with Hayes Smith and Southland for all of those paper mills to convert to long wood. They all went to long wood and started using the skidders and the it converted the harvesting industry of southern pine as it will never be again. It used to be all the old darky with a truck that would just barely run, and they worked for a dealer, and the dealer would supply them with gas and power saws and would help them get their trucks fixed and whatever in order to keep them moving 4-foot wood. Well, when it got to a point where they just couldn't supply the mills on 4-foot wood, then they started doing something else. Now it's gone on to even a higher degree of technology where they have chippers that they take to the woods, and they literally skid these logs tree length to a chipper, and it chips them and blows them into a van. So when you see a van come down the road, you can't tell what's in it, but it could be chips on its way to the mill. And of course, we went from that technology to putting in what's called a chip mill out on 103 west of Lufkin. We have a very large chip mill, and we chip both pine and hardwood. So we're able again to use the hardwood that was the small hardwood tree length logs that were culled. They were given away. They were burned. They were just whatever. They were waste. We now bring them in truckload logs, tree length loads, as you can see coming out any day on 103, going out to our mill. And if you go out there, there are thousands of cords of this wood stacked out there, and it makes its way to a very gigantic chipping operation, and it chips tons and tons by the hour. And so this is these chips then are transported by one of the local contractors to our mill in at Evadale or Orange and or whatever other paper mills may be required. And so that's another, and so that changed the understanding
of chips.
Pardon me?
Do you export any chips?
No. There have been some operations that do, but we've always found a source for our chips here locally. And beyond that, we're expecting in the future to be receiving chips from abroad, namely our venture in Mexico, which was a joint venture again that didn't prove out, and so we took it over and we're running it. It's a Temple venture now, and it is operating with some species that we're not familiar with here in the United States, but they are very fast growing, highly productive species.
Is that eucalyptus?
That's the eucalyptus, and they have some other species down there as well, some other kinds of pine and other forms of hardwood. But they're experimenting, again, this is experimentation as to what species are most suitable, have the right kind of fiber that fit in with our paper mill interests. And also the paper mill people seeing this new product are able to start working on the new technology required at their mills in order to utilize this material more effectively. And so it all kind of goes hand in glove. And the big thing that gets it moving now is someone thinking about, you know, a new vision. Arthur always had vision.
Always thinking ahead. Yeah, I mentioned that I was in Beaumont from early 95 through the end of 98, and John Roby is the transportation manager at the port there in Beaumont, and I had talked with him about, you know, possibilities of what all was going to happen with sending those chips up, but, you know, that's what they were working on then. This is several years ago that I first talked to him about it.
Well, we did it with the Japanese when we sent them waste metal products prior to the Second World War. And some of the some of our competitors who find a surplus of fiber beyond their mill requirements, or in looking at the markets of available standing timber and wood fiber, if they can get it harvested and to the ports cheap enough, and if the markets overseas will pay enough, they can make a buck on it. So they're making money on it. It may come home to haunt us in the future, though, when we start looking at the demand of fiber for all of these mills that are now operating probably, below capacity. And they're operating below capacity because the paper industry, the paper markets are flooded, and so there's not a profit in operating at those higher levels. But if and whenever it does, and in time, as the economies are inclined to do, you know, some of them are cyclic, and as this comes back, you'll see these people will stop shipping that wood, or it'll become vastly more valuable to Japan and other Pacific Rim operators. But I foresee that the plants that we have will need more fiber, and yet there will be many more plants developed all around the world where a lot of fiber is going to find its way offshore, and that's something we're going to have to start. And that's the reason we're involved in Mexico, and why we're looking at it hard and fast now. We don't want to leave our shareholders without the assurance that we are looking at those opportunities and problems.
Going back a little bit more to the logging end of it, what would you say is the biggest technological change during your career, the logging end of it?
Well, I don't know just exactly how to hit that one, because I started out at whistle punking in the woods with in the western species, and it's come from animals to cable systems and vast logging operations by rail, and these skidders now. They've taken over the process of moving logs and wood fiber in the woods, excepting in areas where it's very steep. And there again, then we've got another one, because we even log some by helicopter. And helicopter logging is a very acceptable process on the western slopes, especially because of the high sensitivity to damage. The soil types and so on are very, very susceptible to damage, and that's the big skidders or the big cable systems and they do damage to the surface and site degradation. So the helicopters are finding a way in it. So, you know, we've gone from doing it by animal and virtually horses and mules and oxen and everything, all the way up to doing it with helicopters. And in that process, the biggest innovation that I think had the most effect on the operations, though, was a simple tool that a guy in Enumclaw, Washington, invented. He had a truck, Buick Automobile Agency, and in the meantime, on Saturdays and so on, he'd work on, because he lived in the wooded areas of Washington State, had a lot of logging contractor employee customers and so on. So he worked on innovating a new tool, and it was the skidder, the logging skidder. The first one that he built, I was familiar with.